This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, the government prepares for tough new laws on union regulation in this country. We'll be joined by the Attorney General, Christian Porter, soon. And a drug scandal overshadows a successful swimming competition for Australia and South Korea. But testing for drugs is time-consuming and it's critical to get it right.
We're still retrospectively testing samples from London 2012 Olympics. Last week, the 60th medal had to be handed back because of doping. 8 of the 60 medals were gold medals. This is a significant integrity threat for sport.
The US military is pushing to build more than $250 million worth of naval facilities in Australia's top end in a move that's likely to raise tensions with China. The proposed spending is contained in draft defence legislation tabled in Congress last month, but few other details are available. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
Over the weekend, Exercise Talisman Sabre came to an end at a closing ceremony in Brisbane. This year's joint military training with the United States coincided with news the number of Marines deployed to Northern Australia has now reached 2,500. Just before this month's war games got underway, AM revealed secret planning had also begun for a new port facility outside Darwin, which could eventually help accommodate the large American contingent. Although the US Army's visiting Major General Ron Clark had not been keen to discuss the idea.
I'm not at liberty to answer that question at this time.
Senior government officials insist the commercial proposal for the Glyde Point area, 40 kilometres from Darwin, is still being examined. But the Defence Department maintains it has no plans for the development of a new naval facility in the Northern Territory. It's an idea that also caught the Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, by surprise last month.
There's no plans for Glyde Point that have been forecast by anyone.
Now, AM has uncovered a US military bid to spend more than $300 million on naval construction in the top end. The proposed spending is contained in the US Senate's annual defence legislation, tabled in June. No other details of the project are provided, and Australia's Defence Department is saying little. In a statement, it's told AM,
"It is still progressing through the US Congress and must be reconciled with the House version before it is finalised. It is not yet approved. We expect the US Department of Defence will provide details of the funding in accordance with its processes and timelines following consideration and approval within the United States government."
In 2015, Washington expressed disappointment that Chinese company Landbridge was awarded a 99-year lease of Darwin's existing port. But government sources concede Beijing is also likely to be angered by any new maritime facility which could be used by American personnel. The US Embassy in Canberra has not responded to requests for comment.
Defence correspondent Andrew Green. Federal Parliament will rise at the end of this week for a five-week break. One of the government's industrial relations bills will dominate much of the week. In part, it aims to ban union officials who regularly break the law from work sites. Meanwhile, over the weekend, serious allegations were made against the casino giant Crown by 60 Minutes, the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, saying it had brazenly flouted regulations on numerous occasions. Gambling is one of the biggest and most controversial businesses in Australia. Joining us now is the Attorney General and Manager of Government Business, Christian Porter. Welcome back to AM.
Good to be back.
First to the allegations about Crown Casinos. Have law enforcement agencies given you a briefing about these very serious claims?
Look, I haven't actually seen the show because I was in the air travelling to Canberra, but I will watch it with great interest. I mean, we receive briefings and there are a range of investigations that go on with great regularity, particularly into financial crimes and money laundering. But I'm not specifically aware of anything that pertains exactly to the terms of the program that was aired last night, but that's no doubt something that will be briefed on shortly.
Yeah, there were serious allegations of laundering at casinos, fast-tracking of visas, claims of ill treatment of workers. They're serious allegations.
Well, I'm sure that they are. And money laundering and the relationship of money laundering and the ability to conduct that through gambling operations is obviously something that federal authorities keep their eye very, very closely on.
Would AUSTRAC maybe give you a briefing on this?
Well, I'm sure that there will be briefings coming. I just haven't received them yet.
The Ensuring Integrity Bill, for that to pass, you'll need crossbench support in the Senate. Have you got it?
Well, we're discussing the matters with the crossbench, but, you know, there's nothing set in stone at the present point in time. But there have been public comments by a number of the crossbenchers about their concerns around the behaviour of certain rogue militant elements of the union movement. Obviously, they're concerns that the government absolutely shares. And we'll be discussing that with the crossbench over the coming days and weeks. But tonight and today will be the House of Representatives' passage of the bill. So you need to take these things one step at a time. But the point of these bills is to regulate matters that have been largely unregulated as they relate to what are known as workers' entitlement funds. Now, $2 billion under management. There's all sorts of examples of that money just being utterly misused and misappropriated. And then the first bill about ensuring integrity for unions is just to ensure that those rogue parts of militant unions that repeatedly break the law have proper recourse in the courts, and the courts can stop people from becoming public officials if they're not fit and proper people. We just think this is absolutely basic.
The government repeatedly makes that point, but Senate crossbencher Rex Patrick says that he thinks that there is a political element here and he's uncomfortable and he'd like to see removed that provision, for example, that says that a minister can make a referral to make a union deregistration. That does not apply in the corporate world.
Well,
he has a point, doesn't he?
That has a long-standing history in industrial law, and in fact,
he presumably knows that, and he says he's not comfortable.
Well, these are things that we'll discuss with Rex, and I think one of the interesting things about Rex Patrick is Rex has long been a campaigner and champion for integrity, and obviously that integrity isn't just about inside government or the public sector. There has to be proper behaviour in unions, and we've had federal court judges note that rogue militant elements of the CFMEU have been such repetitious lawbreakers for so long and shown absolutely no inclination whatsoever to ever make any effort at all to change that culture, that there's now not sufficient deterrence at Commonwealth law to stop unlawful behaviour on workplaces. And that actually endangers the safety of employees in Australia. And anyone who looks at this with a rational eye and understands the history of it, I think, is likely to support this bill ultimately.
How big a problem is the underpayment of wages in Australia?
It is clearly an issue. There was a migrant workers task force which, amongst other things, looked into this and made 22 recommendations, all of which we accepted as a government. We've very significantly increased the resources of the Fair Work Ombudsman to the tune of in excess of $10 million, which
is the body that's been made already.
Which is the body that investigates these matters. So they're now being policed and investigated more heavily than they ever have been. But it's clearly an issue. But again, part of this is about setting up the right system of deterrence to ensure that when people are caught, that the punishment means that there's deterrence for others not to do the same thing.
Well, the government is now using that term wage theft. That's a pretty big toughening of language.
Well, it's a term I think that necessarily applies to circumstances where there is large amounts of underpayment. It's done knowingly. It's done repetitiously. So it reaches a standard that doesn't look unlike fraud in the criminal sense, that you could prove that someone has knowingly defrauded people of money that they were owed. So I've got no difficulty in using that type of language for that subset of underpayment that is truly criminal in its nature. Of course, the issue here is going to be how to define that subset so that you don't haul small businesses who did the wrong thing but did so unknowingly across the coals.
You said last week, this came to the fore last week because of the George Columbaris fine of $200,000, which you said was light. Some experts say that penalties should be up to around $10 million. Is that kind of thing warranted?
Well, I think that the maximum penalty, in my view, could probably do with some upward work. I think there should be a criminal penalty for repetitious, knowing and large underpayments. There will always be a range of other considerations. So there is also in this area what they call enforceable undertakings, which is like, if you like, a civil settlement to the matters. Sometimes they will be appropriate so that businesses themselves don't suffer and other present and future employees of businesses themselves don't suffer. So there will always be room for those types of enforceable undertakings, but you don't want to see them overused, if I could describe it that way.
Well, that's what got the banks into trouble, isn't it? The use of enforceable undertakings and no one
ever...
Well,
I think it's what it got Commonwealth regulators into trouble rather than the banks. It didn't get the banks in enough trouble. So I wouldn't want to see enforceable undertakings overused. They clearly have a role to play, and you don't want to take the enforcement of a particular civil fine or penalty to court if it's going to cost people more than the actual fine, and the taxpayer, I mean, there. But there will be obviously circumstances where you really need to argue the nature of the civil fine very hard in court, and clearly there need to be penalties for the worst, most egregious types of this underpayment, which are criminal in nature.
All right, Attorney General, we're out of time. We could keep going, I'm sure, for half an hour.
No problems.
Thanks for your time.
Cheers.
Swimming Australia's come under fire for its handling of Shayna Jack's positive drug test, but legal experts say the organisation was right to keep the affair secret for 2 weeks. It was originally claimed that Jack left South Korea for personal reasons as the team was preparing for the World Championships there, but at the weekend, Jack revealed that she'd failed a drug test. In a lengthy statement overnight, the swimmer confirmed that the second test, or the B sample, had proved positive for the substance ligandrol. She says she didn't knowingly take a banned substance, and the statement goes on.
I have never missed a random drug test, and I always have my whereabouts up to date. In Australia, in a sport like swimming, I feel there is no possible way for an athlete to intentionally take a banned substance and not get caught. I get tested approximately every 4 to 6 weeks, so why would I take anything banned and do this to myself?
Our North America correspondent, Jake Sturmer, has been covering the World Championships in Korea. I spoke with him a short time ago. Jake, what's the latest?
Well, Sabra, the tournament has now wrapped up and Australian athletes will be leaving South Korea today, but not without great uncertainty that's been caused from this doping scandal. I mean, it's actually been quite a successful tournament for Australia. They finished in fourth with 7 golds, 9 silvers and 7 bronze medals. But of course, it's all about Shayna Jack and the impact that her positive doping test has had on the team. She released a statement late yesterday that suggested her positive test may have come from a contaminated supplement. And I managed to speak to Shayna Jack's coach, Dean Boxall. He told me he believes her claims that she doesn't know how the banned substances entered her body.
Obviously, she's going through a hard time, and I fully support Shayna, but I do fully support the process, you know. As soon as we found out that she left, she wasn't here, we've gone through the process, and we just got to let it unfold. So it's in the lawyer's hands, but she's been taken care of.
You're confident she'll be cleared by ASADA as this process happens?
Oh, you can't be fully confident, can you? I mean, it's in front of the lawyers, and, I fully trust and believe Shayna.
That's swimmer Shayna Jack's coach, Dean Boxall, speaking there. And, Jake, what's the next step for FINA, the International Swimming Federation, and Australian team management?
Well, essentially now the next stage of the process, you can hear pretty clearly from Dean Boxall, is that Shayna will be consulting her lawyers. Essentially, Swimming Australia has been forced to defend these allegations of a cover-up because Shayna's statement yesterday revealed that the organisation knew about this positive B sample for more than a week. And the fact that it only came out towards the end of the tournament has had some questioning whether that's an appropriate notification process. Now, Swimming Australia, for its part, says legally its hands were tied, but there is now questions in how this process will carry out. ASADA will be looking at its investigation, and that's a process that, even if Shayna Jack was to be cleared, could perhaps rule her ineligible from the Tokyo Olympics anyway, just because of the kinds of durations that these investigations tend to take.
Jake, how do the other swimmers feel about this case, and does it throw a pall over the whole championship?
Well, there are certainly now, you know, a lot of clouds that have been caused by this positive test. We've heard it in a statement from Mac Horton. He says he was let down by the news of Jack's positive drug test. He said he was disappointed to learn that a fellow Dolphins team member had recently returned the positive A sample. We've also heard from American athletes. It sparked a fierce backlash from fellow competitors. American champion Lily King was very quick to criticize. She has been an outspoken critic of Sun Yang and says she now considers Shayna Jack to be a drug cheat herself. But not everyone in Team America is so critical. I also spoke to Ryan Murphy. He's a three-time gold medalist, and he told me the kind of news has a really devastating personal impact. And I think we can really get a sense of that from Shayna Jack's statement that we've seen overnight.
That's our North Asia correspondent, Jake Sturmer, in South Korea. And remember, this Korean swimming comp is the same event where Australian swimmer Mac Horton made world headlines for refusing to stand and shake hands with Chinese swimmer star Sun Yang, who's still under a cloud. The Jack case has raised questions about whether Australia has a double standard on drugs in sport. David Sparks reports.
The former head of ASADA, Richard Ings, yesterday accused Swimming Australia of trying to cover up Shayna Jack's positive drug test. But other experts say Swimming Australia did the right thing by staying quiet. Nikki Dryden is a former Olympic swimmer for Canada and is now a human rights lawyer.
My understanding of the rules is that they do have to keep it quiet. It's in the athlete's hand as to when he or she wants to reveal. Now, obviously, that changes over the evolution of the process. So the process isn't just like you test positive and that's it. There are a whole host of things that go on, from testing of the A sample to testing of the B sample to the provisional suspension to the investigation that ASADA goes on, and then to the actual case that's filed against you, your response. So this is going to go on for months.
Professor Jack Anderson is Director of Sports Law at Melbourne University, and he shares that view.
Unless and until ASADA completes its investigation, and unless and until the athlete herself makes it public, well then Swimming Australia followed proper procedure and policy and did not make the provisional suspension public.
Shayna Jack is now in Australia with her family and continues to claim she has no idea how the banned substance got into her system. She's been provisionally suspended. The timing is awkward for Australia after the country got behind Olympic champion Mac Horton's stand against accused drug cheat Sun Yang from China. FINA chose not to suspend Sun for breaking rules during a visit from drug testers last September. But the World Anti-Doping Agency is challenging that decision at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Some have criticised how long that process is taking, arguing it should have been completed before these championships. But Nikki Dryden says she can understand why it's taking so long.
Both parties would have had to agree to an expedited process for it to happen sooner. So I think the normal course was that September it will be decided. You know, perhaps it could have been done a little bit earlier, but, you know, you're not going to do it in the week before the World Championships necessarily.
Regardless of what comes of the Shayna Jack and Sun Yang cases, Jack Anderson says we need to ask ourselves some serious questions.
We're trying to vindicate the rights of clean athletes. Catching cheats is secondary. And I just want to give kind of one context that is important. We're still retrospectively testing samples from London 2012 Olympics. Last week, the 60th medal had to be handed back because of doping. 8 of the 60 medals were gold medals. This is a significant integrity threat for sport, and we must deal with it in legal and ethical terms.
That's the Director of Sports Law at Melbourne University, Professor Jack Anderson. That report from David Sparks. In the UK, particularly in London, there's been a dramatic rise in knife crime. It dominated headlines last year when almost every day someone was stabbed to death on a London street. More than 100 people have been stabbed to death this year. Some blame austerity measures, a platform of the Conservative government over the past 10 years. Our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley didn't give it too much thought until someone was stabbed right outside her front door.
In London, there's barely a day that goes by that a stabbing death isn't reported. More than 100 people have been stabbed to death this year. 40,000 knife crimes were recorded last year alone. 2018 was London's bloodiest in a decade, with 132 people stabbed to death. I only really started to think about this more deeply when someone was stabbed outside my home in southwest London in broad daylight. Police tape surrounded the area. I approached an officer and asked him if I should be worried. No, he said, the men were known to each other. I took that to mean they were in a gang. Not long after, I was walking past the Houses of Parliament at Westminster when I came across a protest. families of knife crime victims, clearly still grieving, had gathered to rally against what they say is government inaction. And so I stopped to speak to the organiser, Kaya Osborne.
There are ministers who are sitting back and they're watching everything that's happening. They need to step up now and they need to take control. Changes aren't being made quick enough. Young people are dying at a rapid pace and it's becoming norm now. People are being desensitised to it. It's like you can go on Facebook and see, oh, well, there was another stabbing in my area. Maybe a few months ago, I was like, oh, wow. Now, it's got to the point I'm actually seeing it. I was like, oh, OK. Yeah, no stabbing.
And show me your hands. And what's that symbolising for you?
The government have blood on their hands. If you're going to be doing things like taking away resources for young people, taking police off of the streets, you know the problem you're creating. It's logical. It's logistics. You know how things have gone in the past. You know how to make change. If the government really, really wanted to make change and get rid of all the serious youth violence, one simple thing needs to be done. Increase the sentences for anyone found with a knife. Just found with a knife, yeah? If you make it 5 years, like anyone found with a gun, I guarantee, knife crime, it will plummet. So why don't they do it? Because obviously we know these prisons are still making money from inmates. If they're not getting new inmates, they're not making any more money. So it's actually in their best interest to keep crime flowing, really. But we've had enough. It's on our doorsteps. It's not on their doorsteps. It's our young people dying. It's not these affluent people who have their children in private school and stuff. It's not them. So something has to be done. This is the army.
And you've known people that have died because of knife crime?
If I was to literally go through names of people I know who have been murdered, whether it's knives or guns or any other form of violence, even suicides, a few, we'll probably be here for the next 3 minutes. And I'm not exaggerating.
And then I'll join in and give you another.
Yeah, so there's a hell of a lot. And it continues.
That's activist Kaya Osborne, and he was speaking with our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley. There aren't many places more remote than Gillam in northern Canada, the location of a huge manhunt for two teenage murder suspects. Now people in and around Gillam are feeling a little vulnerable as the search for Bryce Kamelski and Cam McLeod, who are suspects in the murder of Australian Lucas Fowler and his American girlfriend, Gina Deese, continues without any sightings. North America correspondent Connor Duffy reports.
The peace and quiet of the frontier lifestyle suits Susan Sularate and her one-year-old daughter perfectly.
We always help each other and everything. What's going on, we always tell each other around here.
But that peaceful life has been interrupted by the hunt for accused killers Bryce Kamelski and Cam McLeod. The teens have been charged with the death of Canadian Leonard Dick and are the prime suspects in the murder of Australian Lucas Fowler and American Gina Deese. As the police and army search backyards and constantly fly overhead, Suzanne Sularake is on edge.
It's scary.
I bet it is.
Yeah, it's scary how it is right now. Never seen all these people around here.
This morning, police were back to work, searching the morning train headed out of town. Again, they came up empty-handed. At the town's airport, a Hercules C-130 military aircraft has been flown in to offer support. Arriving on a much smaller plane was Travis Bigotty from Bear Clan Patrol, which has travelled from the province's capital to provide support to the local Indigenous communities.
I believe right now there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of fear because this is not something that they're used to. It's usually a very quiet, isolated community, and then all of a sudden there's fear for their lives.
When AM visited the Cree Nation community of Fox Lake, most people were staying indoors as police patrols knocked on doors and planes passed overhead. Travis Bigotty and his team are helping the Royal Canadian Mounted Police reach witnesses they may not have heard from.
So one of the other things too is providing that communications between RCMP, the police, the army. Most times community members don't want to speak with the police because of past experiences. And so we're there kind of the voice or the communication bridging that gap between all parties.
Nearby, local kids Brock Flett and Leslie Spence are hoping it'll all end so their friends return and long summer games resume on the quiet dirt streets.
I'm not really sure it's safe for the kids to play out anymore here.
People are having to stay indoors.
And it's pretty scary because they're not used to it here.
Yeah, it seems like a very quiet place.
A quiet place. It's nice here.
Police and much of Canada also hope the quiet returns soon. This is Connor Duffy in Fox Creek for AM.
The new chair of the Minerals Council of Australia and former Howard Government Minister Helen Coonan has become the latest business heavyweight to call for nuclear power to be considered as part of our energy mix. Nuclear energy is currently banned in Australia, but Ms Coonan says it should be on the table along with renewables as industry moves away from fossil fuels in the coming decades. During her first interview as the new chair of the Minerals Council, Ms Coonan spoke with our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan, who first asked about her stance on mining regulation.
Well, the important thing here, I think, is that there should be proper process, but there is enormous duplication and delays that stop productivity. For example, if project approvals were sped up by just 1 year, it would release something like $160 billion to national output and another 69,000 jobs.
But what about something like Adani's Carmichael mine? Are you satisfied with that approval, given the environmental concerns, but also the future of fossil fuels?
Well, look, I think the big important thing with Adani was that those approvals, of course, I think mean that it is very safe. It went on for 8 years. It probably shouldn't have been that long. And there are other examples wherein project approvals are taking 16 years. So there's something about project approval that's a handbrake to the proper processes of mining exploration.
But what about the long-term viability of a miner like Adani? They've had to self-fund because no bank in Australia, China, the US or Europe would bankroll them.
Well, they wouldn't be proceeding if they didn't have the business model to be able to sustain the mine. And if you want more nurses, hospitals, police and infrastructure in areas like Queensland, that's the way to do it.
A forensic accounting specialist told the ABC last week that Adani is a corporate collapse waiting to happen, even likening Adani to Enron. Now, Adani says those claims are false and misleading, but do you worry at all about Adani's financials?
They've obviously know their business model and they are confident that they can finance it.
But it seems clear that exposure to fossil fuels will diminish in coming decades. For example, Norway's sovereign wealth fund is dumping billions of dollars in fossil fuel stocks. Glencore is pulling back. BHP says climate change poses an existential risk. That surely means the business model for mining needs to adapt to survive.
Absolutely it does. And the Minerals Council supports a gradual transition to a low-carbon economy. Coal, be it gas, even, dare I say, it's about time that we have a conversation about nuclear power.
And nuclear power is controversial. It's one of those not-in-my-backyard issues. But is it time for Australia to really take that on and get that to the people?
There's a long way to go, of course, because there are legislative barriers. There needs to be political will. I think certainly would encourage the government to have an inquiry because that will enable all of the factors to be teased out, including storage and safety and the new technology that's now available.
Does Australia have a big enough population to support the expense of creating nuclear power stations?
An inquiry would tease out what this new, for instance, smaller modular type of nuclear power can do. It may not require the kind of very large-scale investment of overseas nuclear power stations. So certainly there are various surveys now to suggest that the Australian population is at least up to have a conversation about it.
Australian shipments of coal remain held up off China, still awaiting clearance from Chinese customs. This has been going on now for a few months. It's a pretty serious issue given the importance of China for Australian exports.
We understand in the circumstances that there have been some delays at some Chinese ports. We very much support the government's diplomacy and advocacy behind the scenes to try to understand better the issues involved.
You say it's a matter for diplomacy, but do you see that there's anything else behind this, given the current tensions between Australia and China?
Well, of course, they're sensitive discussions, but we support the government taking the lead on this and being the advocate that will go and understand better what the issues are.
The former Howard Government Minister and now Minerals Council Chair Helen Coonan with the ABC's Peter Ryan. Ms Coonan is also a non-executive director at Crown Casinos, and that interview was recorded before the allegations at Crown Casino were aired over the weekend. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
In a tiny Canadian town called Gillam, people have spent their weekend locking their doors and hunkering down.
That's because police have been searching the area for two murder suspects at large for almost 2 weeks.
Today on The Signal, we're following the story of how two Canadian teenagers looking for work ended up wanted for the murder of three people, including one young Australian guy.
Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.